Okay, they've closed the doors, which means we're supposed to start. I ought to make all of you move to the front and then say your names. Come on, introduce yourselves. This is Managing the Media Blur. I'm Douglas Merrill from Google. And to my right is the to my right is the illustrious and somewhat toolish.
Only temporarily.
Quentin Hardy, writer extraordinaire from Forbes. And Quentin's going to start today.
We're going to talk about managing the media blur, but before I begin, I'd like to thank the Amazon rainforest for sacrificing itself on behalf of our next 3 days of digital entertainment.
And for the benefit of the podcast, he just lifted the bag of 5 million pages of free handouts that they got.
Yeah, if you go to the film one, you get a different bag equally big, too. It's a cubic foot for every person. What I want to say right at the start is that great internet wizard Desmond Tutu was correct. There is something happening to change the climate of consciousness on the planet today. He didn't even have an email account when he said it. There is something changing in human consciousness. Point A, it will change the way we feel about ourselves. It'll change the type of society we live in. It'll change political structures. What I want to say that's equally, if not more important, is this has happened a bunch of times before. There is nothing weird here. And it's very, very interesting to think about the ways in which it has happened before, that ways in which technology, particularly communications technologies, have affected perception, the sense of self, the sense of power in the world, and what that has done. So I'm going to run through a couple of examples pretty quickly, and then the smart guy will talk. The first picture I threw up here, I want to start with print. Print is the best possible example I can think of. That is an image of a scriptorium from the early 15th century. There's a couple things I'd like you to notice. First off, the size of the page. It's determined why. Well, that's basically the monk's reach, what he can write in easily. It's determined by what the monk is doing. The other thing you need to look at is, of course, the pages run to the size of the books, but look at the books in the background. They all have chains on them. They're very, very immobile for the reason that the books were going to stay in one place. They're difficult to produce. They're very valuable. They were not sold. They were kept. The monk was the key part of the process. Can you get the next slide up? This is a page from a Gutenberg Bible from around 1455 or whenever they started doing them. And what I can't show, but it is the same size as the manuscript page. It was exactly the same size. Now, why is that? Because every new technology begins by imitating its predecessor. The future always shows up with big chunks of the past in it. And they start with what they know what to work with. So they made books, and they made them this big, of course. They couldn't match the illumination quality, but they could stress density. They could go on speed of production. They could go on cost and use that to change the world. Next slide. This is where books ended up, and I don't mean devils hauling you off. That's the image is from a Danse Macabre around 1490. Back in those days, you may see that people used to be entertained by images of gratuitous violence and the suffering of others being rendered on them. And we've evolved beyond that now, but it's good to remember where we come from.
Play GTA.
Yeah, right. But what I wanted you to look at is this. So they're coming to take people away from a print shop, and there's a couple of interesting things about it. One, this is the first well-known industry with a division of labor. Capitalism and communications are closely tied together. Capitalism and print are closely tied together. And also, look at the books in the back. The chains have gone, and they're smaller. They're portable. What happened was, around 1490, various Venetian printers discovered paper folding, that you could make books actually much smaller and portable. And it really changed the entire meaning of them and how learning took place, and that these were objects you could vend pretty easily and carry around in your saddlebags and educate people broadly. They also quickly exhausted everything they were printing. They started pirating like crazy. They started translating like crazy. Conveniently, the Turks overran Constantinople so that a whole lot of ancient texts were rediscovered, sparking the Renaissance. They were translated. Why am I going in this direction? The act of translation into vernacular languages elevated the power of vernacular languages, the really notable one being Martin Luther translating the Bible at a time when print made it impossible to stop it. People had done it before, but the translations were able to stop. The church had its first formal book burning in 1510. It was too late. The train had left the station. So print is directly responsible, in my view, for the Reformation. And then as a knock-on effect, this new vernacular, power of vernacular language, led to nationalism. Suddenly people organized themselves around this common power. It became interesting to think about where French ended and German began. It was a new form of political organization that the technology inadvertently delivered. The next slide up. I could quickly go to a couple more examples. You can see where I'm going, though. A key mechanical innovation has an unforeseen social change, usually based on some of the key dimensions and the way it affects people. I want to talk briefly about photography and war, just to show another example. That's a painting of the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Freudian slip.
And as you can see, it makes a nice little triangle down the side, and the guy is dying in his white shirt without a lot of blood. It's very neat. It's very heroic. It's nothing like what war ever was, but that's how it was depicted and how people understood it. Let's go to the next one. This is the Battle of Antietam, a bunch of corpses strewn over a field. The great salient dimension of photography was you could just show the world, and it elevated the everyday into a kind of heroic status. And this was true certainly with the way Jacob Riis, for example, elevated the life of the suffering of ordinary people in ghettos. Photography, more than anything. People could not ignore these things. People could not ignore the way war took place. And next slide. It elevated who the leaders were. Napoleon is depicted as this, you know, noble, eternal. Grant is slouching. He's every man. His heroism became the heroism of every man. And that's gone on to this day. Things changed slightly with electrical media, with the telegraph and, that kind of reach and that immediacy. Not only does everything in the globe start to matter to people, but, there's a kind of anxiety around connectivity that we're still dealing with. You just put this up very quickly. I guess it's a podcast, so I have to read this now. This is a passage from The House of the Seven Gables, and he's talking about the advent of telegraphy, and he says, "Have I dreamt it, that by means of electricity, the world of matter has become a great nerve vibrating thousands of miles in a breathless point of time? Rather, the round globe is a vast head, a brain, instinct with intelligence. Or shall we say it is itself a thought, nothing but thought, no longer substance which we deemed it." They were disappearing off the physical world even then due to electronic media. Radio has an interesting dimension that I think pertains to where the internet is going. Radio injected voice, giving the powerful a kind of intimacy into people's living rooms and a kind of extra authorial power. It's interesting comparing FDR and Hitler in this picture. Hitler wanted to bring you a man in an auditorium. FDR wanted a fireside chat. And the two split the world that way. You know, it was a whole different style of political delivery. We know which one won for the most part, or at least, I'm not gonna go there. but it created a kind of near-far problem that we've had to deal with ever since in our electronic media, that the internet is changing today. And I'll get into that in a bit, but, what was amplified was the powerful celebrities, political figures, and also on the other end, the near. It's interesting how many TV shows that were successful create families of one kind or another, or illustrate families of one kind or another. Going from, you know, Lucy, The Simpsons, Cosby Show, even Friends, it's a sort of family of people. The Sopranos being the dark side. It's getting increasingly diffuse and diverse, however, because people are watching television alone, or there are a number of different televisions in the house now. They aren't watching together. And that has to do with the kind of entertainment that appeals to them. Okay, what was taken out, though, in this was the kind of neighborhood fraternal organizations. They suffered as a result. Those are emblems from the Elks Club, the Knights of Pythias, the Women of the Moose, the Shriners, and... I can't remember what the one in the corner. The Masons, thank you. And these used to be 30 or 40 of these in any good sized town, and everybody attended them. And you had an interest, yourself was defined not just by your family and your relationship to the distant powerful, but your neighborhood, your civic organization. These have died out, I would say, to some large extent because of the nature of the information we're getting these days. But note the little trendy groups coming off them. The internet may revive these in novel ways. Now you can see the monk is now working on a laptop or a tablet PC, and he's up to some new mischief. The salient dimensions of the net, I think, are becoming apparent. They're not fully discovered, but much like the history of all the other media I've talked about, people began by imitating the past. What they call Web 1.0 is the imitation of magazines and television. Graphically, it looks like that. And then it discovers what it can do in its own way. And, you know, we'll stop calling it Web 2.0 eventually. It'll just be what the internet is. And so, you know, what are the dimensions that you think about? Well, it started out by imitating its predecessors, but now it involves obviously massive amounts of information. And massive amounts of information in partial forms, snippets, that are connected in novel ways, creating new levels of information, the contrast itself becoming another form of information. I guess what I'm saying is Nathaniel Hawthorne was a punk. If you think he had a lot of information, the planet was a big brain then. Wow. So partiality, massive level of information, an ability to connect things, yourselves, others, information, the way to connect yourselves and others in all sorts of novel ways. The self as an actor, as a sometime participant, as a publisher, as a spectator, means that this near, middle, far, kind of hard and fast delineation I'm making is going to disappear into a series of sort of expanding and contracting circles that overlap, if that isn't too dynamic an image. But there are neighborhoods that are created, neighborhoods of trust, neighborhoods of common interest, neighborhoods in some cases geographic, in some cases emotional, that will ultimately become and have become political entities in themselves, that will become an important part of how we see ourselves, what we do. This is still being seen in some ways. This is still becoming apparent. I think we're sort of like monks in the year 1470, wonder what the hell happened. You know, this print thing, what's it mean? But it's good to think about it now. So there is this information blur, as we called it in the topic. Translation, machine translation, which is getting increasingly more powerful, will make this even more so, obviously. But I want to turn it over to Douglas now to talk a little bit about managing this, because managing the flow of the information becomes a very, very important point, part of how it will move out into the world and how powerful people will assert themselves.
So the winning line, I think, in what Quentin just said is that Nathaniel Hawthorne was a punk. I mean, I've never quite heard that before. Does that make it like the Scarlet P? How does this work? Okay, so the Quentin and Douglas Punch and Judy show has always got Quentin talking about 1,000 years of history and the dialectic that is modern society. And it's extraordinarily erudite, and it covers everything from usually, you know, political organization to social organization.
Yeah, next time I make the Friends pig picture.
But you know, at least in this one, he included The Simpsons, which I feel better about. It's kind of a big step down now that you guys are about to experience. So I'm sorry in advance. Quentin talks about societies. I talk about people. I'm a psychologist by training. And when I think about managing the media blur, I think about, what does media mean? Media fundamentally is a methodology for conveying information. And information in and of itself is valueless. What matters is an action. Humans do things. They do things based upon information and inferences they made upon that information. Any psychologist, however, will tell you that humans are actually pretty stupid. You know, we're remarkably bad at a lot of things. The other point that Quentin made, I thought really compellingly, was this has all happened before. There's nothing new here. We all talk about information overload as if it were a new thing. But since mankind evolved, we've been overwhelmed by information. We just don't pay attention to most of it. To wit, how many of you are aware of the pressure of your shoe on your left foot right now? You all are now, yeah. But you weren't 30 seconds ago. And yet your body was sensing it. Those nerves were firing. And they were the nerves, the sensory nerves were going to the lower part of your spine, which was responding back with a, through the beta channel saying, ignore this. And you did. You didn't attend to it, but it was still there. Information overload has always been present in our lives. We just talk about it more now. Humans, there's been a study for the last, I don't know, 50 years or so called cognitive psychology. And the idea of cognitive psychology in the more modern form of cognitive science is, how do people solve problems? How do you learn? How do you learn to do things better? And I and a bunch of other people have done studies in this. The first step in learning is attention. You must pay attention to something. Ann Treisman and others have studied attention, and they discovered a bunch of interesting things, like you don't consciously pay attention to much, but you unconsciously pay attention to a lot. Her, I don't know, sort of the funniest great cocktail party story is the cocktail party effect, which is you're all sitting in a cocktail party or a talk like this, and in the background you can hear the little bit of the noise from the room next door, and maybe you can hear people in the hallway talking. But you pretty much tune it all out, much like the feeling of the shoe on your left foot. But if someone says your name, you'll hear it immediately. It's called the cocktail party effect. It's true. You're attending to a lot of things. You're just cutting most of them out. Those things you attend to get copied into working memory. Working memory is where you work on it. Hence the name. Kind of creative naming.
College boy.
I'm a college boy. What do you want? Out of working memory, things get encoded into long-term memory. After they're encoded, you can recall them. And after you recall them, you make some decision on, and so, you know, you recalled them for some reason. There's been volumes and volumes and volumes written about decision-making biases. Kahneman and Tversky and their students made hay, you know, writing about decision-making biases. I'm not going to cover that ground today. I want to talk about recall. I want to talk about recall because fundamentally, if you're going to make a decision, you have to remember something, some bit of information that some media carried to you. Recall's easy, right? We're good at it. Yeah? Nod your head, shake your head, make some physical motions other than breathing. Very good. Thank you for playing. No, we suck at it, actually. We're quite terrible. You're more likely to recognize something than you are to recall it. So if I show you something you've seen before, you're more likely to recognize it. But if I ask you to tell me, you'll likely fail. A guy named Brian Reiser did a study where he asked people a simple question. Remember something. Specifically, remember the last time you went to a restaurant and ordered food and got something you didn't order. It's a simple task, right? But it's actually quite difficult. In my case, I've never actually gotten something I didn't order. But if you have, here's what you do. You elaborate. You say, well, when would I have been at a place that I might have not gotten what I ordered? You know, what might cause that? Well, maybe I was in another country. So what restaurants have I been to in a country where they don't speak my native language? Oh, well, there was that Mediterranean place I was at in when I was in Africa last, and you know, my French is bad and their English was bad and it didn't work out so well. And you do what's called elaboration. You elaborate what you might have been doing, what you might have been trying to do in order to find a memory to do something with. Elaboration is important. I studied human tutors for my dissertation, and it turns out if you look at skilled human tutors who are trying to teach something sort of uninteresting like programming, they spend a lot of their time trying to make sure that you, the student, are clear on what you're trying to do. So they'll ask you questions like, are you sure about that? To which the answer is always no, right? The teacher asks you if you're sure, the answer is, oh, I must be wrong. They'll ask you questions like, what are you doing right now? Or what do you think that test is supposed to do? Not in those cases to tell you that you're wrong, but rather to get the students to articulate the goals they were trying to achieve. And then, you know, we did a bunch of studies of how tutoring worked, and we built a system. And in that system, fundamentally, you programmed in it, but you did a couple things differently. You made notes of what you were trying to achieve. You made predictions of tests. And you were you made notes about the goals you were working on at that moment.
Did you ever dig into why that was effective? Were they projecting themselves in it? Were they sort of willing themselves toward it? What about saying their goals?
So what mattered was by encoding what you're trying to do, by encoding that, you're more likely to by encoding your goal stack is what it's called, you're more likely to be able to find it later. Rather than simply performing a simple rote task of programming, you're taking from working memory into encoding. You're encoding an intention. You're encoding the ability to try and do something so that later on, when you try to do that again, elaboration is simpler. You're more likely to be able to find it. And suddenly you're a much better coder because you can remember, oh, hey, I did that once before, right? That's the lesson of cognitive science is pretty clear. Get people to mark what they're doing and what they're trying to do as they're doing it, and they're more likely to be effective later. Okay. So for those of you who are still awake, and that looks to be about 1/3 of you at the moment, you may be asking a pretty fair question, which is, who cares about learning to program? Later on, a bunch of people at one of the think tanks called RAND did a study of high-performing army units. We studied people at, I think, the National Training Center, which is a place that that army battalions go to do training. We studied radio transcripts from a bunch of famous battles, et cetera. And we noticed something interesting. Units that were more successful than you would expect, given their makeup, had some interesting commonalities when they were planning and executing the attack. Specifically, there was someone whose job it was to say, well, hang on, wait a minute. Are you sure about that? Hang on, I'm sorry. What are you trying to do right there? Hey, does that sound familiar? In highly successful units in the real world, in the U.S. Army, one of the things that predicted success was having somebody make sure that the unit as a whole articulates what it's trying to do, what the expected results are, and what goal you're working on at that moment. So now you've got a bridge from little tiny laboratory experiments on Lisp programming through to skill human tutoring through to an experience in the real world where people's, you know, lives are at stake. Whether your position on war is irrelevant in this context, you know, in some sense, a measure of success is shown by those inputs. All right. So if it's so important, so if immediate purpose is to carry a piece of information, and decision making is important, and you're more likely to have a more successful decision if you articulate what you're doing, why you're doing it, and what you expect it to happen, why are the tools that we've built to build and interact with our world so poor? So fundamentally, what that says is that knowledge, acquisition, and use in today's world and understanding of media ought to be active. You should be doing something. And yet, in fact, all of us were raised in a world when you watch TV and listen to Tom Brokaw talk, and you just sit there. Tom doesn't ask questions. Or if he does, you don't answer. Well, maybe you do. I don't know. But let's ignore that for now. There's medication for that. So we've raised an entire generation of journalists and consumers to think about media as passive. I'm sitting here listening, much like you guys are doing now. I'm listening to some sage talk about something, which means you're not engaging in any goals. You're not making it clear what you're trying to do. What's the likelihood that you're going to be able to usefully use that information? Not as high. If you think about it, this partially leads to the rise of citizen journalism. All of a sudden, journalism is not just sitting there listening to a talking head. It's actually telling a story. It is the democratization of information. History was always written by the winners. The monks got to tell you what happened. I don't want the monks to tell me what happened. Pop quiz. What's the difference between a revolution and a civil war? Answer, who won? If the government won, it was a civil war. If the insurgents won, it's a revolution. Why should the outcome determine the nature of truth? It shouldn't. So to me, we need to continue building tools that, one, enable people to tell their stories, two, enable people to tell their stories across languages, to Quentin's automated machine translation point, and three, tools that allow you to search for information with the context of what you're doing, so you're more likely to find the right stuff. And all this doesn't bode very well at all for the current mass media market. If you're a magazine writer, how do you engage with your audience? If you're a broadcaster, how do you engage with your audience, Quentin?
Well, as you see, I've been writing down while Douglas is talking, and I do type 60 words a minute. Don't mind working late hours. I'm Quentin. Doomed. Okay. I don't think so. But I do pick up a couple of your points, and I think they're pretty interesting, particularly the one about the job of someone who has to state what the goals are. because this reminds me of it's so interesting talking to online game designers. They will tell you about how in online games, very frequently what happens is a group of like-minded people will find themselves somehow inside the game and organize typically with about 50 to 100 people. Past that, somebody will split off and start another one. But there is a leader, there is a commentator, there are people who connect to the outside, there are people who find things from the outside and bring it in, and there is basically an in-house scribe who sort of, you know, says to everyone, here's what we're doing, here's who we are, here's what we are. And that's a kind of event that's very important in online gaming frequently that I think is part of the future of journalism, i.e. knowing how those groups operate without putting up too hard and fast rules, setting them up and making them operate effectively. I'll give you two quick examples. One, a friend of mine was talking to Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, or the, you know, sponsor of Wikipedia, however you want to define it. And they asked, you know, why is it so effective? And he couldn't figure out at the time why Wales said this, but he said, well, what made it so powerful is everybody knew what an encyclopedia was. In other words, they arrived with a common story. It wasn't a lot of fighting over, you know, it's a series of short articles, you know, and we will write them, but they arrived basically kind of showing up aligned about what they were doing and who they were. And, you know, it bloomed from there. Another interesting one in this regard is Talking Points Memo. How many are familiar with Talking Points Memo? Which is journalism. You know it? What are you laughing at?
You just positively commented on messaging training. You know that, right? Journalists are supposed to hate messaging.
Whatever.
All the PR.
I'll ask you what that meant afterward.
All the PR people in the crowd are really happy right now because learned that their job is important.
Well, I didn't know how much to explain Talking Points Memo, but the interesting thing was it just won a major journalism award, first big website to win this coveted award, and they won it for a kind of crowdsourcing they did involving putting together anecdotal information around the country that indicated the Justice Department really was targeting certain attorneys general who weren't lining up with the team, and there really was this in-house witch hunt going on.
How did they do the crowdsourcing?
Well, they got 3,000 emails, you know, from the Justice Department and put them up and said, you know, help us go through these. Oh, you guys take this, you guys take that. And within 24 hours, people had gone through them and pointed to the emails that were interesting to them. What happened was Washington was trying to do its usual thing of, sure, full disclosure, here you go. And a reporter will just throw up his hands because it's very hard to go through that. So they crowdsourced it out and had it read back.
Interesting.
What makes it effective, though, is everybody was following the narrative to begin with. They knew what they had to look for. They were familiar with the salient points of the argument. They were, in a little way, sort of like up on the story the way a journalist is. I'm not sure crowdsourcing, you know, this is, so to get to a point around managing this media blur, for a manager per se, it involves finding people or yourself articulating who you are and what you do and getting people aligned inside the story in correct ways.
Which kind of begs the question of, you know, identity is a really simple notion when you tie it purely to physical presence. It seems like a much harder notion in the world you just described. Who are you and who do you listen to?
Well, what are our passions? You know, and the person who can articulate the passions correctly becomes important in the organization. You know, that's I don't think that's that difficult. The challenge, and many panels I walked through or have read about today, are talking about how important editing and selecting and filtering are, how these are the great sort of, I would say, narrative tools here, because it's all out there. How do you pick and choose among it? Which is not really a crowdsourcing task. That's up to a few individuals, typically.
So how do you, so if you believe that there should be a few individuals editing and filtering and selecting, that seems contrary to the notion of everyone getting to tell their story. The power of the pen then rides with the editor as opposed to the monk. Did you guys notice the monk has a Bluetooth headset on in this picture? I mean, this picture
ready.
Scares me a lot.
I think obviously there are blogs where you get to be the hero, but does everyone tells their story? How is that not noise?
I don't know.
But there has to be, I mean, perhaps it's a sort of a moral argument as opposed to a practical argument. There has to be some notion of collaborative filtering that allows people to tell their story and then allows me to transitively figure out what I want.
I would say ways that the most compelling argument, the most compelling example can rise to the top, but we are seeing those.
Yeah.
You know, they get noticed. But you don't want to hear from everybody all the time. Otherwise, you're back in the media blur.
Yeah. And you're just listening for your name and the cocktail party effect.
Yeah. Now, as for the likes of a Tom Brokaw being doomed, which is what you were telling me earlier, I think, you know, right now, it's bad news for a Walter Cronkite, who stands there just sort of delivering this impartial stuff and was the trusted source. It's been, well, it still is very good for the Bill O'Reillys of this world, who are extreme, because it's sort of a bad filter or a good filter, depending on how you like Bill, but it's an extreme.
Aren't you on that show regularly?
Yes, but that's a, how long did you want to go? you know, anyway, it's an environment of extremes, and that gets noticed, and it's a kind of primitive filter that better filters will probably rise up over time. More interesting is the manager as filter chooser articulating voice against the crowd, which is potentially a way to see the future of journalism.
But I want to be able to say, okay, here are the activities that I'm interested in right now, and then have a set of tools that go crawl across the world and say, here are other people who are interested in those same activities at this moment. I don't want to have to a priori say, you know, I want to read Douglas's blog, or I want to read Quentin's blog, or Quentin is my friend, and thus I transitively trust his friends. There ought to be some way to do search with context, and search where context is the activity you're working on.
Well, you're the one with Google on your card. Why don't you talk a little bit about tagging and the importance of it, what it represents, and how this stuff gets found.
So the problem with, I mean, I think, so clearly tagging is part of the right answer, but tagging is typically done on not at the moment of creation as opposed to on the way to doing something. So my sense is that tags are getting created more like the Dewey Decimal System, right? We're trying to sort of normatively categorize things.
Past.
As opposed to saying, why would I want to use this information? What was I doing at the time I created it? It feels like we're tagging in the wrong way. And then we're not really well situated to do any kind of search-related activity tagging because I can't specify what I'm doing right now.
Well, is it possible to encode emotional valence? Is it possible to tag with some level of experience? Here's what I was going through, or here's what this meant to me at the time, and have that be some search function?
I don't know. Interesting idea.
Sort of like the plus one, minus one on Slashdot. We should probably engage the crowd, though.
Okay.
Come on, guys. You have to ask questions.
Comments? They have a microphone here. I think they'd like you to speak. I'll repeat the question for the podcast.
Because they've spent all this time making tags, which we also call subject headings.
Yes.
But that's a formal, descriptive language. And so being able to combine those community tags is one of the things we're working on right now.
What is a community tag?
Repeat the question.
For our pod audience, we have a librarian in the house. She's talking about tagging and
in the catalog.
What is a community tag? Right.
They were selected by someone. One of the questions that I've been asking for a long time is, what happens to libraries when patrons become publishers?
The question is about authority, and the authority typically was what had appeared in between hard covers, the author. Where does authority stand when everyone is publishing? Which is to say that authority is diluted, it is inflated into meaningless value, possibly. I guess the question is, what are the new sources of authority?
Yeah, I think to say that if one defines authority as a sole source, you know, sort of, then you're sort of back in the, you know, basically the monks asserted they had authority from the word of God. And, you know, it turns out people have different perspectives on the word of God. Who knew? I think this, it's hard for me to envisage authority as a single valued entity. I believe that authority is an emergent property, or should be an emergent property from groups.
Well, I think, you know, obviously the crowd choosing certain people is one, but another one that I think is interesting to think about is so-called authenticity. This happened to me, and therefore it is true. It's interesting to think of how many liars are writing high voltage memoirs nowadays. They're perfectly good works of fiction, but really they publish them as memoirs because that authenticity is extra. And similarly, I would say that in a digital age, non-digital experiences gain relatively more value. It's interesting to think about the way that music is free, but people fly to Austin to see a bunch of live bands. You know, you could catch these guys at home on your computer without going through this effort, but you're not going to get that authentic experience. It's the relatively scarce thing. So authority, in a way, is relative scarcity.
And it's pretty hard to argue. I mean, it's likely that people's, you know, this happened to me, will indeed be given more authority. But on the other hand,
eventually not.
But that would imply that, you know, we would all believe in space aliens having kidnapped people. You know, your one's notion of experience is actually pretty weak authority.
Yeah. So,
for those of you who have been kidnapped by aliens in the audience, please forgive me.
Andreas, could you come to the microphone? Otherwise, I. No, scarcity influences authority. Yes.
There have to be a lot of signals, and that could be one.
Okay. Yeah. I think that the relative scarcity gives things greater value. It's a supply-demand function as much as anything.
Yeah, he works for Forbes.
Well, I do think that
I just made Quentin Hardy lose his whole train of thought.
First time.
Yes, I do work for Forbes. And I do believe in markets. I do believe they are a great source of information. And I think that new kinds of markets and perhaps markets in authority will arise in this environment. It's interesting to look at the new markets that are already being generated by digital technology. And you were in Africa, I was in Africa, and people in very desperate countries in Africa trade minutes as readily as they trade money at this point. Getting access matters more than the local currency often.
You can buy live chickens in South Africa with your prepay minutes.
Yeah. It's obviously perceived as a currency that inflates more slowly. It has a higher retained value for people. So I think there, you know, that might be one kind of market that will become more widespread. Another one being anonymity, which could be milled more closely. I will exchange this level of anonymity for you to reveal something of yourself to me, and that will give you more authority. You're actually willing to put some of your identity on the line. And I'll grant you more authority in this exchange or on this blog.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So your assertion, I think, is that markets in some sense create information through the trades that occur. And so if you can figure out what markets need to clear,
yeah, the
to create authority.
The exchange is a third value. It's a comment on what we're valuing.
That makes a lot of sense. I like the idea of having multiple signals that matter and basically making markets in each one, identity. Yeah.
Another question. Yes, in the back. Please come to the microphone.
Please,
the
please,
pod guys
please.
Are suffering.
Set a good example.
Thank you.
Sure. How you doing? Thanks for the speech. My name is Steve O'Donoghue. I work for Radar Networks, and we have a product called Twine. And shameless promotion.
Product placement
very, very,
moment.
Very, very relevant. Very, very
So, Steve from Twine.
Twine. Did I say Twine? Twine.com.
Well, as long
there's
as
a question with this too.
As long as it's relevant advertising that's targeted to the audience, I'm fine with it, dude.
Now, was that swine?
T-W-I-N-E.
Oh, Thara, thank you.
The question is, you can tell us if we're going to be successful or not, maybe. We have what we call an interest network, which is used to create, people create twines, which are like a collection sort of around their interests.
Uh-huh.
And you can post all kinds of digital assets to any twine that you create around your interests. You can invite other people. You can communicate around your interests. And there's all kinds of permissions. And if you want to make it public or if you want to keep it private. And what you mentioned on the tagging was also interesting in that we have an auto-tagging feature in there. So as you add interests, our auto-tagger function will comb the content of the URL or pull out the tags that are built into the URL and accumulate those onto the interests. And then the theory is that the more data that goes in, the more knowledge will come out. So instead of creating extra clutter or solving the clutter problem, the more stuff that you gather and dump in, the auto tagging feature and some rating and voting systems that we have built into it will facilitate better knowledge out of the clutter. So it basically does the cocktail effect for you in that it knows what your interests are, and the tagging will bubble up those interests for you. So is it going to work?
I don't know. I guess we'll find out, but it's interesting.
Oh, but do you worry about
percentage user growth, man? It's all about percentage user growth.
Do you worry about becoming a victim of your success? Do the tags get clunky after a while as more and more people layer on them? And similarly, does the market start to distort itself by people trading in, or exchanging inside this?
Maybe. We'll have to watch out for that.
Okay.
But I guess the thing is that, I mean, at Google, you probably see this. I mean, there's millions and billions of new web pages coming online every day.
Yep.
And it's getting, I mean, Google is an amazing service, but it's getting harder and harder to find the information that you want around your interests through Google. And if you have a more segmented area of the net on your interests, based on your interests, which also is more enriched based on the feedback from the community that comes in on those interests, you may be able to carve out a bit more of what you're interested in and sift through the chaos and get to the information that you want. So it's not the information overload and the blurb that we're talking about.
Well, we like competition, so I hope go out and get lots and lots and lots of users.
I would never compete with Google. You're too good.
Why not? Well,
but
please do.
Yeah. So watch out for twine.com.
We shall.
Twine.
Thank you.
Well done for the good ad.
Well, I'm an old media reporter that, that is real jaded. But one question I had is that Google, when are you going to launch a news channel where you actually, like, pay citizen journalists or people for the content? Because if you were to go to Google News right now and put in South by Southwest, you'll see a whole bunch of entries come up. And most of them are from traditional media. And most of the stuff that's frankly any good is from some traditional media. Okay, I'm stepping out on the line there. And a lot of the bloggers, they make a point of trying to get themselves in traditional media because it gets them higher rankings on Google and places like that. So my big question is, it seems like a mess out there. I know traditional media isn't doing it right, but I'm not convinced that new media is doing the right thing either. Everybody's got a video camera at this conference. I mean, but there's no content being produced worth consuming out there that I can see.
Well, this panel, clearly.
Oh, well, of course.
Robert Scoble, and I went to work for Fast Company and am running Fast Company TV now. I didn't join them to get better blog ratings. In fact, writing a column for the magazine didn't improve my ratings at all. Being on CNBC for an hour didn't even affect my refer ratings 1%. So if you want to get better ratings for your blog, don't go to old stream media. The reason I went there was to get a sales team that had a clue. They had relationships with people who brought money in.
She has a good point in as much as mainstream or old media is an enormously valuable touchstone to the rest of the blog world. I mean, if the New York Times went out of business, the bloggers would have to chip in and bring it back so they could react to it every day.
It's true.
Somewhere the Murdoch family is listening and thinking,
Yes.
And it's that, so we're looking at there being more stuff than can be selected by humans. So it sounds like the challenge that you guys are talking about is how do you automate or crowdsource or both?
Well, I think there's two parts to that. One, can tags be developed effectively and filtering technologies be developed effectively so that relevant things that are relevant to you come right back up? Which may be an interesting charge to what are now privacy issues but may go away in the future, because you'll have to reveal what you're interested in and who you are. Another question, or possibly the same one told differently, is can you encode taste?
That asserts that taste exists.
Sure.
So I think in general, obviously, I'm at Google and I have a pretty strong opinion that generally speaking, human filtering is pretty weak. Humans carry pretty strong biases. They're pretty sloppy. You have to have some sort of, crowdsourcing, co-sourcing, co-filtering. But I want to have I really want to see more things than, maybe Quentin wants to show me.
Yeah, but I don't expect you're going to be able to build a machine that's going to say, this is who we are and this is what we do. That act of taste, that statement of identity.
We'll see.
The race is on.
So my question is, given the ubiquity of authorship, how does that affect our ability to, of some future civilization to come back and tell the story of now when they themselves will be suffering from information overload? And it kind of ties into sort of another question, which is, how do we encode metaphor? How do we kind of cross disciplines when we're encoding information? So, because, for example, Machiavelli or Sun Tzu, they didn't start out writing business books, but nowadays mm-hmm. it's required reading for the business world, for example.
Did you ever read the Sirens of Titan? Mm-hmm. There's a great thing in the Sirens of Titan where this guy pretends to be from the year 10 million AD, and he's come back to the present. And the people are very concerned, how are they telling our story in the year 10 million AD? And it turns out that around the year 8 million AD, there was just too much information everywhere. So they shortened the history books to read, after the death of Jesus, there was a period of turmoil lasting approximately 1 million years. we'll get shrunk. Of course, our experience will not be accessed.
Right. So there's a famous, it's hard for me to stand in front of a group and quote Ayn Rand, but I'm going to anyway. So tell me how you really think about me. Says, have you read The Fountainhead?
I have.
Tell me how you really think about me. Well, I don't think about you.
Yeah.
I don't think civilizations of the future are necessarily going to care that much.
Well, they'll read about the past to find out about themselves.
Well, exactly.
But there won't be to the extent there is a story, you've assumed the answer in your question, and that answer I'm not sure is right. I don't want there to be a story. Robert's position on many things and my position on many things don't co-vary a lot, all due respect. I like you a lot. So why should he win? Or why should I win? Who cares? I don't want there to be one story. I want there to be a chorus. I want there to be a chorus of demons, that none of whom agree, so that whoever is looking in the future can look back and say, did we do the right thing? I don't know.
But don't you think that leads to then some siloing of the populations, that this is my version of truth, this is your version of truth, and never the twain shall meet?
I think in a world with fluid identity, that's why I said sort of growing and shrinking circles that overlap. Hard and fast silos probably aren't the best visual image to attach to it, because people are assuming different identities all day normally. You can talk about this till you run out of breath, I'm sure, but in the virtual world, even more so. So I don't think those silos will pertain.
It's a good worry, though.
So last night I read an article on the Free Atlantic Monthly or something like that was referred to by Reddit.
Oh, Wired. The Wired cover on Free. You can get it to newsstands for $6.
It's actually in that bag you were holding.
Yeah.
It was,
no, I gave mine away.
It was on the union who controls the port workers in California threatening to strike unless we pulled out of Iraq. I read this last night, so I go online and I'm trying to find more information about this. But I keep seeing other news agencies keep referring to the same article as if no one has bothered calling the guy. I almost feel like it's up to me to call the guy to figure out if the information's true.
Please do.
Why do they keep, why do so many traditional news agencies keep referring to each other about facts of an article instead of going out and actually investigating?
Yeah, so
it feels like it's under information.
Well, and you think linking isn't the same thing?
See, it feels like I'm a little surprised that Scoble's not jumping up and running to the mic and saying, see, this is another example of media stealing the blogger's thunder. Come on, this is your line.
what is linking but granting authority based on someone saying so?
If you're referring to Reddit, it's a news. I look at it as an aggregator.
No, but if you go through the blogosphere, somebody wrote something, and therefore I'm commenting on it and giving it that extra dimension of truth. Yeah. Sounds like he did know where they got it from. They kept referring to the same article.
Some of them did. Some of them just didn't cite, but it was the same word, so it doesn't really matter.
So that's responsible versus irresponsible linking in a different form.
But I mean, the future of factual media is pretty touchy, right? So we raised a generation of journalists to think of the five W's, right? Who, what, when, where, and why. So journalists care about facts. But in fact, if you look, for example, at the day that Anna Nicole Smith passed away, if you look at Google search logs, you'll see it hits the wire. There's a massive search spike of people who want to find out the facts, and then it sort of dribbles off a little bit. And there's another spike, which is basically the news media going to find out who, what, when, where, and why. But
we
everyone
have predicated discussion of responsible journalism on the death of Anna Nicole Smith.
But everyone who already cares about the facts knows about it. So I would argue that actually we're arguing kind of about the wrong point. I don't actually think the facts are necessarily the most important part of the discussion. They're relatively easy to go find. What matters to me, at least, is the perspective and the integration. So I would have asked your question, the same question slightly differently, which is why could there be multiple copies of the same article with no differences in perspective? No two of us in this room share any perspective on any interesting topic. How can there be multiple articles that say the same thing? Leave aside the responsibility versus irresponsibility point. I'm trying to elide that part, because clearly irresponsible copying is bad, right?
Which got to the question I was going to ask, which or comment I was going to make, which is that for a lot of these things, the reason those all exist is because someone figured out a way to make money doing that, right? That replicating all this content, you end up, any of these systems that come to pass end up useful for a while and then full of spam and full of, you know, a lot of the same stuff.
Except us, of course.
Except you, of course. I used to be involved in a blog search company, and it turned out no one really needed blog search in that respect, because so much, no matter how much we did, there was so much of an opportunity to simply, you know, you look for a particular subject, and you would get 20 or 30 or 40,000 different iterations of the same article with Google AdSense attached to them. And, you know, that was a way that people could make money. And it turned out when we had a big deal with a major media company to provide them what they thought they were going to get was blog search. What we really provided them was with the capability of doing a whitelist, of picking three blogs to put out, and that was more than adequate for their needs to provide for their massive audience. And, you know, what ends up happening is massive audiences do need editors. They are willing to consume what people tell them they're supposed to consume. And that happens in media, it happens in wine, it happens in restaurants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a certain group of us who really value the community and the crowdsourcing and such. And then there's an awful lot of people who say, tell me what I'm supposed to like.
But I think given the choice, almost
price
everyone
is a
would
filter there often too. Mm-hmm. If it's a little more expensive. Did you see this great study this week in the New England Journal of Medicine about placebos?
Yeah.
The $3 placebo is more effective than the 20 cent placebo.
But to your point, I think almost everyone would, given the choice, would say, I'd like to choose who's going to do my filtering for me. I don't necessarily want to read everything. There are filters I trust. I tend to trust Quentin's perspective. I always read, there's a set of people I always read. But I want to be transparent and available in my choices of who I allow to filter my reality.
Oh, sure, but you're going to have it. The automated version of that, at some point we trust Google to automatically filter certain things for us, but maybe not necessarily.
Yes, ma'am.
I think we have no perspective on this right now because we're right in the middle of the revolution.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm old, so I have one foot over there in traditional journalism, but I blog. So I've got my other foot over here in new media, and I've got kids. So there's another foot over there somewhere, you know, in collaborative stuff that only goes on cell phones.
Are we playing Twister here?
Well, you know what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the younger people who have grown up with a more collaborative environment are going to have a very much easier time of deciding about authority and trust than we do, because we've had top-down trust you know, Huntley Brinkley, Walter Cronkite, that kind of trust, whereas they're growing up in a more collaborative space where the mob, the smart mob, or the crowdsource, or whatever you want to call it, helps them form their opinions. And it is very different. And we're not there yet.
Oh, well, to circle back, I think the way crowds are styled, the way people affect crowds will be a big part of what crowds determine as well. I'm not sure crowds, this wisdom of crowds thing has its limits, absolutely.
I feel like a lot of people who look at traditional media will read an article in their local paper and not really know where it comes from. And I don't think, I think a lot of people just don't even know. I mean, is it a press service or what? So I don't know. In my experience, it seems like more being able to get it to them. So I wonder if, because right now traditional media has the money to spend on making those filters and making that kind of really extensive metadata, if they have a leg up in over a more independent source. And I guess, how do you think an independent source could rival that?
So I guess interesting. That's a really interesting perspective. My initial thought is that I think exactly the opposite, actually. I think traditional media is, in fact, in some sense, hobbled by the fact that it has an existing monetization model, an existing sales model, but keep it in a particular structure and a particular cost structure. Yeah. Right? Finding a local paper which is profitable is quite challenging. On average, one out of every three spots on commercial radio goes unsold. So, you know, the cost structure of traditional media is actually quite complicated. So I would actually think that that new media, people like many of you, are actually competitively advantaged over traditional mainstream media.
So like an individual person over...
Yeah. Q, what do you think? Do you agree?
There's something to it, but I think... Well, no, the point about how much weight they can throw behind the metadata is definitely true. It's time-consuming, and it doesn't automate particularly well. So, no, I think you got a good point. Yeah. Where I totally agree with Douglas is we are all prisoners of our history, which is to say in a corporation, our org chart. And there are these people that need to be fed, which is why the Yahoo-Microsoft merger is going to be so interesting to watch because, you know, clash of the titans, right?
Right. I guess if you're a traditional media company and can turn yourself around that way, you have a good future. But
again, you know, to underline this woman's point and what I said earlier, we're monks in the year, you know, 1470.
Which means the book burnings are coming in 20 years.
Well,
right?
They are. They'll try book burning. Trust me. I think that's quite likely. And, you know, possibly not here, but maybe in... Well, this is an interesting thing. Have you ever noticed that religions sometimes have lifespans and the Muslim world is sort of getting ready for its reformation if there are timelines of religion?
That's Diana.
Robert.
We've had a chance this week to study some of this stuff up close and personal. I mean, 2 days ago, TechCrunch reported that Digg was selling out to Google or somebody. And in the old world, a traditional print journalist, because I was a journalism major, would have had to have three sources. Well, I could probably go around this room and find three people who will tell me that Digg's going to get sold to Google, right? If you try hard enough, you can find a source that'll tell you anything, right? There's people out there who you know, get on mainstream TV.
You know the great line from the editor of the Weekly World News, the now sadly defunct tabloid? When a woman calls me up and tell me her toaster's talking to her, I don't tell her to see a doctor. I tell her to put the toaster on the line.
Yeah. But the new world is we might go to press with one source or a half a source
or a toaster
or some weird source, right? Or a toaster for a source. But what goes on is I don't trust what I see in blogs for a few hours, maybe even for 24 hours. But within 24 hours, the guy who runs, Digg was on his blog saying this is total bullshit. And within 24 hours, I was here at a party and I ran into Kevin Rose and he said it was total bullshit. So, and now you see the raft of stories going through the blogosphere is like, oh, Arrington screwed up. Arrington's source wasn't correct. And we all know now that source wasn't correct. So the world now cleanses itself after publishing. In the old world, you had to get it right before publishing, which didn't always happen either. But I like this new world better because at least the guy who you're writing about has a voice in this process.
So in this incredibly immediate world, time is the filter?
Well, time is the filter. In the old world, if New York Times wrote something about, you know, Jay Adelson, he would not have had the ability to get his voice into Time, into New York Times Magazine readers. And today, this world is different. We have that ability to speak up.
Thank you. I think we're about to get shut down, so we'll take one more.
Okay.
It's close
Thank
time.
Thank you. I just wanted to address the issue of, you know, quoting articles and sometimes repeating almost verbatim, but I think that it's not always bad sometimes. I mean, I use it on my blog because I think that in the U.S. we tend to focus on the U.S. coming from Europe, and I often quote sites from abroad, either Japan or Europe or whatever, and I think people may not have picked that article, and I think that's worth sharing, and sometimes it's not worth adding anything to it because a person made the statement of what they were talking about clearly, so what do I add by adding something except...
But on the other hand, it's kind of hard to argue that you shouldn't say, I'm copying this content from this blogger in Japan, or...
I mean, I quote my source, I say where I got the I always do that, but when I'm saying... about sharing as well information that might not be, people might not be aware of interest. That's all.
Okay.
Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.